This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
The Peace Paradox.
Lila Fujiwara.
Late 80s, early 90s fantasy film essentials.
And Cambridge Elliptony.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. But today, the dice are not being rattled, they're being rolled softly onto felt. The miniatures are thumping, but they're thumping approval, and the Doritos are replaced by tiny finger sandwiches. Peter Frampton doesn't need to change because he's always been for peace. We are in a peaceful incarnation of the gaming hut, perhaps unexpectedly so, because today we're going to discuss the peace paradox. What happens when the players, instead of fighting, the players talk themselves out of the fight? And how does that make everyone feel? Robin, you have thoughts on right. this matter, because you, as a Canadian, are a representative of peace.
Yes, exactly. So the paradox part comes in, where it's something the players really want. It's the big final thing at the end of the session. It's the moment you've been building toward. And instead of fighting, this is a thing where talking is not only an option, but it is paid off. And what do you do then if the thing the players really wanted to do and have now succeeded at leaves the end of the session feeling a bit of a letdown? They didn't want to fight, but if they'd had a fight, they would feel more like something big and dramatic and exciting happened, and they just very intentionally avoided having something happen. How do you end your session, or even possibly your campaign, I guess, with a sense of victory? How does it feel as exciting as defeating opponents and seeing them flee from you, or, fighting to the last little bit of breath and one of you collapsing and healing and save? That's all so exciting. And here you've made a deal, which is what you wanted, but also you probably had to give something away. You had to make some compromises. So the obvious answer, which we're going to dispense with, is, well, then that leads to another fight, right? Is that it's, you made peace with the nomads from the desert, and that just makes the farmers from the valley mad, so they hire some mercenaries to attack you for having the temerity to have made peace with their enemies. Well, that does have a big action sequence at the end, and it's obvious because it does sometimes work. Sometimes it doesn't work, though, is when the players go, hey, we spent the whole session trying not to have a fight, and now we've been punished for a peaceful resolution by having another fight. What's up with that? So they might well go, well, we're glad we defeated those ungrateful farmers, or they might go, I got cheated. I didn't get what I wanted. So what are the other ways, Ken, to have a sense of climactic resolution that isn't just a big old dust up?
Well, the climactic resolution basically is about the players ending on an emotional up note that says, we're going to, you know, probably have a fight later. This is a role-playing game in which fighting is the main occurrence. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be having a paradox about it. So you set up the next fight as rapidly as you can, though not enough to nerf the peace talks. So the peace talks are meant to keep you alive. You know, you're on the way out of the dungeon, having peacefully talked the dragon out of the fight, and you get ambushed by a bunch of bugbears. That just makes you mad. But you make it up out of the dungeon with the scrapings of the dragon's horde that the dragon has allowed you before putting the rest of his horde in a bag and flying off to his mountain. And as you get up out of the dungeon, maybe you see where the dragon lands. You see that little spot of blue landing on the mountain ridge. You hear about the dragon mountain that's got a bunch of dragons, and they've all got their hordes there. And that's where dragons go when they've, you know, left their dungeon. And you set up the, we're going to get you next time. We're going to move against you. If you made a deal with the evil king to him not to exterminate you with his anti-paladins, and the king's like, well, now you work for me. Here's your crummy, ruined, haunted fortress. Go take that over. You begin to plan. We're going to rebuild this fortress. It's going to be a strategic key of the kingdom's borders. And then we're going to invite in the centipede men, and we'll see how that king likes it. So you get them in the process of planning their revenge, which is how you get over a unsatisfying negotiation.
Right. Another way is to make it feel actively rewarding to have struck peace. So instead of having the farmers in the valley get mad at you and hire mercenaries, they are glad to have peace. And so they then give you the sorts of treasure that you would normally loot from your enemies at the end. So they praise you. They might compose a poem about you and then present each of you with an exciting magical treasure so that you feel that sense of reward. And if you have built an emotional connection to the people who you are benefiting with your negotiations, then they can praise you and you'll be happy about that. And you can fast forward further in time to, and here are the fruits of your negotiation. A whole harvest season passes, and in fact, no raiders come to steal the grain after the farmers harvested, and there's another big feast for you. And so you feel the sense of excitement and happiness and victory there. And so it's not, in that instance, it's not the fun of foreshadowing a future fight, but you get to sort of bask in your glory for a little while longer than you normally would, because you freed up all of that time that would have been spent on, you know, a 45-minute fight on a 15-minute negotiation scene. And so here's a bit where the players can, you know, celebrate what they've done and, you know, also put some new stuff in their bag and write some stuff on their character sheets.
Another type of negotiation, as opposed to the sort of truce or worse yet, abject surrender, is the, you know, give some to get some type negotiation. And in the negotiation scene, one assumes you establish what you were giving up, but now is maybe the time to enjoy what rewards you did get. If the rewards are more substantial than you weren't curb stomped by a dragon, then you can go around the table and say, now that you're buddies with the evil king, what do you plan to do with your new court access? Or now that you have made a deal with these raiders, what thing about the frontier over the desert are you curious about that the raiders could bring you news of? And so every player gets to have something that they gained story-wise out of the adventure, in addition to any solid gold goodies they scraped up from the bottom of the horde cave or were given by the peasants from the peasants' own horde cave. Although if the peasants had all this cool magic items, one wonders, are they holding out? No, no, that's back in the revenge area. We can't be going on that. But the notion that by negotiating, you have decided to weave yourself into the universe of the game in some way means that you should be allowing the players to find out what else they're doing in that universe with their new priority access to it, with their new peaceful reputation.
Right. And you can give them the opportunity to build something. So now this isn't so easy for the, you know, standard group of F20 adventurers who are just going from place to place. But again, it's like, well, you now, you've been given a ruined tower by the enemy who's now your uneasy ally. And maybe now, you know, you can upgrade that allyship to, you know, a full friendship if you build out the tower, or you can build up your tower as a defense for the inevitable betrayal that you're expecting. And so you can give them another project to work on. And so the end of the session is not going to be as dramatic as a big fight, but you are also can be rewarding the players with a sense of, you know, here's some me time. Here's where you get to develop your own agenda and further that and kind of start to build your power base a little. Another thing could be just that it leads into another unrelated adventure. So you don't feel that you were punished for making peace, but after you make peace, then the farmers come to you and say, hey, that was a really great way that you convinced the centipede men to be our frenemies. That's great. But there's these worm friends who've started hanging around and we're not so fond of them. Could you look into them? And so that way you basically end one scenario kind of at the 2/3 mark with the negotiation. And then it feels like a reward then to have another adventure because that other adventure is framed as you are so good at having done that, that we're going to give you this because of course your objective is not to stop adventuring. It's just to choose which fights that you have, and you chose not to have that other fight. Mm-hmm. And so this is leading into something else. And so you can sort of have the, you know, essentially the first hour of the next scenario can occur to take the place of the fight that they got around. That way they actually did get around to fight and they have a bunch of investigating and stuff to do. And that's probably an easier pitch for a straight up F20 group of characters who don't want to be involved in politics. They don't want to run a tower. They go into dungeons to not run towers. So here's another adventure for them.
Yeah. This is something that I try to do as a GM is when my players decide that they want to make a deal instead of have a fight with some overwhelming force or just one that they just don't want to fight that day. I always try to have their new ally offer them a shot at one of their other enemies. So the theory being that not all bad guys are in a league of evil in the kingdom. The chaotic evil guys hate the lawful evil guys, whatever it is. You've made a deal with the lawful evil king. He says, I know you hate that necromancer. I've had my eye on him myself, but I don't have, you know, guys that are strong enough to take him on. But what I can do is I can give you the plans to his temple because he has to file those with the kingdom every year to get his tax subsidies or whatever. That may be a little ornate for an F20. But anyway, the king has some sort of leverage or weapon that he could use against the necromancer and he gives it to you to do. And so that, you know, lets you pivot to the next fight without it instantly negating your good job of negotiating. And it provides your reward in the sense of you now have a leg up on another fight that this time you can, you know, bring the hurt instead of go to the necromancer and make a deal with him. Although maybe you do that too. I'm not the boss of you, but as you say, if you are standard F20 players and not budding Talleyrands, then a +2 arrow aimed at their next enemy is a lovely gift from anyone.
Now, in other cases, the players are not looking for a permanent peace. They just want a delay to have a fight on their own terms, in which case they are the ones who are going to execute the inevitable betrayal. And that's the easy setting for this question, right? That you just delay, have a withdrawal, and then the climactic bit can be perhaps after a jump ahead in time, the players beginning to build up their power base so that they can attack that enemy and win on more favorable terms. And that's one that, you know, just takes care of itself, really. They withdraw and then you say, well, now what do you do to set up the situation? And you can have, you know, an element of suspense around that where The enemy is no fool. They've sent someone to spy on you, or there's a floating invisible eye keeping track of what's going on so you can keep the tension up while you, you know, plot against them. And you could do sort of a funny thing where it takes them longer to get back at that guy because some other problem comes up. But that's perfectly fair, right? That you,
yeah.
If you weaseled your way out of a fight instead of heroically going for a plowshares over swords, the players know what they're getting when more trouble comes their way.
And this is the absolute classic. I mean, this is the as old as F20 itself, practically. You, in the olden days, going into the dungeon was more like a reconnaissance in force the first few times than it was a straight up Sherman's march. You'd go in, you'd be like, oh, bugbears. Then you'd run back out and you A, might have leveled up, but B, you're like, okay, we have to, you know how to handle these bugbears. And you go back in and then, oh, giant spiders. And so then you go out of the dungeon and you think, how do we handle giant spiders? And then you go back in with your, you know, rings of fire shooting or whatever. And this sort of call and response to the same dungeon is built into the bones of F20 play. So it's not just, I think, you know, satisfying on sort of a story level. It's satisfying on the deep bones of the game that you're playing, that reconnaissance in force is what you can sort of mentally retitle what might seem like a crawl or a cowardly sprint out. You're like, no. We were just checking up on the Blue Dragon's defenses, and now we're going to be ready. And the negotiation is just the way that you got out with your, you know, armor intact, right?
Right. And you can have some fun byplay between the players who are deciding, you know, some of them, if there's conflict within the group as to whether that was an honest deal or whether you're going to immediately get to work on the inevitable betrayal or just set aside some inevitable betrayal contingency plans, that can be a fun little scene that, again, is entertaining because it's the players interacting and can help smooth over the flatness of just sort of waving your potential adversaries goodbye. Well, it's time for us, Ken, to wave goodbye to the gaming hut. But fortunately, another segment awaits us on the other side of this exciting commercial message. ''1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozu Kepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase. Hello and welcome once more to Ken and or Robin Talk with Someone Else. And today, the someone else we're talking to is at Gen Con, which is why there will be odd air conditioning sighs and strange echoes on this segment. But that will all be made up because we're talking to Lila Fujiwara from, I don't even know if you have a company.
I actually do work, most of my time is spent these days working with Brotherwise Games on the Cosmere RPG.
Right, so. And the Cosmere RPG is what we're here to talk about, because this is as if someone was in charge of the Stephen King RPG, right? This is, I mean, first of all, $14.7 million on Kickstarter, the biggest crowdfunded TTRPG ever. Brandon Sanderson's universe is the Cosmere, for the 9 people listening to this who don't know that. And
It is gigantic. I mean, epically popular is, I guess, how you would describe it. I mean, there's Brandon Sanderson and there's nobody as far as American currently working fantasy authors. Am I right?
When I have conversations with people, I ask them if they know Brandon Sanderson, and it's either like they don't read fantasy and they have no idea who this man is, or they're a super fan.
And so they want, and this is the thing about, I would not wish your troubles to, as in the immortal phrase, a monkey on a rock, because fans of Brandon Sanderson, in my experience, are not shy with their fandom. I mean, I wrote a Star Trek role-playing game back in ancient times, and I thought I dealt with psycho know-it-all fans. You have to be squared and tripled how much are you walking on eggshells every minute, every keystroke of the cursor, or do you have the sort of wonderful Mount Rushmore level of arrogance that I bring to the universe?
Oh, gosh.
And you're like, back away, chumps, I'm in charge of Brandon Sanderson's universe.
I guess maybe I'll try to do a short answer to this. I think the first thing that I want to say is that we have a group of folks who are on our team called the World Singers, who are those know-it-all community mods that are like...
Bring them in.
Yeah, they're in our Discord. They're extremely friendly. Like, I was very intimidated when I, you know, jumped on as somebody who, you know, had read the books but has not internalized the intricacies of, like, how all of the Radiant Surges might intermingle with one another and all sort of, like, the fan theories and stuff. So I think, like, having, you know, people who are experts on the team and then becoming an expert yourself has been, like, a big part of that. But I also just want to say that, like, I do a role that I spend most of my day, honestly, in my room, in my house, you know, like, typing away on a computer. But when I've been on podcasts or come to conventions and met fans, it is a very enthusiastic community, but it's also been, like, a surprisingly kind community, I would say. Like, the enthusiasm... I don't know. I've never gotten into an argument with a fan about anything. Well, like, people are like,
that's
knock on a lot of wood.
Right. No, absolutely, though. And that's great. I don't want to turn this into a whole settler effect of fandom, but I think that Brandon Sanderson's initial fans were just super nice Utah people that don't get in fights. And so that has spread and created a vibe to the whole Cosmere fandom, maybe.
I think the culture, you know, from what I've seen of it, like, is a very friendly, like, welcoming culture.
Right.
Yeah, which I've really appreciated as, you know, somebody who is occasionally, like, sort of a public face as part of this, like, giant RPG, to not have people coming up and, like, quizzing me about things.
And so talk a little bit about your particular path to this epic pinnacle.
Yeah.
What led you to it? How did this happen?
Well, so, okay. Another thing, I'll try to be succinct about it. Yeah, I think that I had, I guess, I don't know, like, a third of a life crisis or something at some point. I had a really enjoyable, 10 plus year career in teaching and technology. Mm-hmm. And in 2020 to 2022, I have been working alone at home for a long period of time. I was a software engineer at Google. This was after spending some time making, like, online programming courses and stuff that had, like, the teaching stuff more involved. And I'll be very honest, I sort of looked at the bank account and I was in a very privileged position, and I'm like, you know, I could keep doing this, but I don't need to keep doing this. And I've sort of been doing the same thing for a while. And I have been playing role-playing games since middle school. And it has always been a thing that's, like, been really core to my heart. So there's I left my job in 2022. It was basically like, instead of focusing on climbing some corporate ladder, I'm going to focus on trying to figure out what will make me happy every day to get up in the morning, which, again, is a very sort of, like, privileged thing to say. I think, like, I could afford to spend some time not making, like, full time, you know, work money. I knew that none of you can see this, but there's a few copies of my independently made game called Jukebox. It's like a tiny zine-based game, the absolute opposite end of the Cosmere. But I'd had this game noodling around in my head about making your D&D session, but, like, the musical episode of your D&D session, and that you could have, like, a karaoke machine going at the same time and be bursting out into song.
Instead of just making the bard do it all the time.
Yeah, instead of just making the bard do it all, everybody's doing it kind of thing. And it started out as, like, a D&D scenario, and I took a course with the Storytelling Collective, which is maybe something that's, I'm not sure if it's come up during interviews, but it's, like, an online community and online course series about writing your first adventure. And so Anyways, I've been doodling on that for a long time. I quit my job. I just like put all of the energy that had been, you know, going towards a, you know, 9 to 5, 40 hours a week job into writing and doing what made me happy and, you know, kind of seeing what happened. And there's a lot more stuff I could talk about, but I know this is only 15 minutes long about kind of like maneuvering and things I tried at like spaghetti that I threw at the wall.
I mean, all that would be insanely interesting, I think, to all of our listeners, and certainly to me.
Yeah, so I guess the jump from publishing a couple of PDFs online did involve going to conventions and getting lucky and like connecting with some people who, you know, saw some of my early work. It involved taking the skills that I learned from managing teams to make online courses and applying that to running projects, but in the role-playing game space.
Right.
And somebody noticing that and saying, hey, I think you might be able to do this in a like slightly larger scale than your like DM's Guild, you know, project and would be successful with that. And, you know, I presume executing well and doing a good job on a couple of my first, like, freelance projects and stuff. So getting attached to the Cosmere RPG, my title is the project lead, and it is a sort of partially operations, people management. I'm the czar of the schedules. It is a role that isn't inherently like writing or creative, you know, to start with. And that was kind of my foot in the door, but it's a small company, and you get, like, there's a lot of needs for people to pick up hats that nobody's wearing and sort of wear them. And one of the hats that I made a case needed to be picked up was we had a bunch of really talented writers working on the Stonewalkers adventure, but there was nobody who was kind of, like, fulfilling in the technical space what would be called like a tech lead, but you know, the role of somebody who kind of has an idea for what the core vision is going to be, sort of like make some decisions, but is also beholden to, you know, the stakeholders and people like Dragonsteel that wants a particular thing, and like our creative director Johnny, who, you know, also has a, you know, vision that he's like hoping to get through with like a product, you know, thing that he wants. And so yeah, I mean, huge props to Johnny O'Neill, who like gave me the chance to kind of pitch on how I would do some revisions on the adventure and, you know, work with the team. So basically the midway, I was doing all this kind of like operationsy stuff, and then midway through Stonewalkers, which is the first campaign length adventure published with the Cosmere, I jumped in on that and started coordinating the team and like helped write one of the chapters in Stonewalkers. And so now my role is sort of a 50-50 split between doing stuff that just keeps the entire team running and making books and things, and having my own little kind of corner where I'm really focused on what it means to design adventures in the Cosmere, which honestly is kind of my dream job.
So. Now, this is interesting because certainly in the tabletop role-playing game space, it so often begins that you're a designer or a writer and you have to become a project manager, a sort of an organizer, a cat herder. And you started out doing all that at real companies and then said, no, I want to write games, and then just cream rose to the top, right? And do you find that that kind of project management is still sort of the dues you're paying to get to write about Magic and stuff, or is the process of managing a project that is not soul-killing software but is in fact fun, cool role-playing games, does that give you enough psychic boost to get through that half of your day as well?
Yeah, I like managing groups of people. I think that there is something really powerful about a team working together and kind of seeing ideas that either you have or other really good ideas that other people have on the team become like, basically, you know, if I spend 8 hours doing, so much writing is going to happen. But if I get into a little meeting, we all decide something, and then like five people are spending 8 hours writing, the amount of like growth and things that you see is like really rewarding, especially if you're all kind of working on the same thing. So yeah, and I think there's also a little bit about like I get, you know, I'm sort of, I started off, you know, being a DM, and sitting at a table has felt like a lot like teaching or like managing a team. The sort of real-time feedback of getting to help people and like seeing people's visions and designs, you know, kind of come together and the things that they want, you know, weave together, and facilitating that is really rewarding when it's going well. So yeah, I think that I am lucky in that I'm not total crap at, you know, kind of managing and organizing things. And I enjoy it. And if you, you know, if you look at the credits of like a WotC book, there is like a, I don't know if it's called a book lead or like the adventure lead or, you know, the rules lead or whatever. There is somebody who kind of is in that position of, they didn't write the whole thing, but they had a high level creative design for it.
Right.
And early on, you know, I opened those books and I'm like, I want to be that person. Yeah, that sounds really fun.
And that role changes names project to project, yeah. And certainly company to company. You know, at White Wolf, it's been developer. At other companies, it's just project lead or just lead designer sometimes. Yeah. So there's all kind of different names for that skill set. And I think, as you mentioned, you're sort of discovering that in our fun little version of capitalism, there isn't anything like defined roles, and there's just stuff that has to get done, and sometimes it gets done and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, this is frankly to me more fascinating than the Brandon Sanderson stuff. Mm-hmm. But as someone who has done my share, perhaps a little more than my share, of licensed material, I think that everyone else who's been in my shoes kind of wants to know, is Brandon Sanderson even aware that he has a role-playing game, given he has a million other things going on? Is he involved? Is he nice? Does he turn around his approval super fast? I mean, obviously he's a great guy. No one has ever said anything worse about him than he seems like a guy who spends a lot of time writing and nothing else. Mm. But I mean, how is he as a licensor? How is he? Does he come in and say, "No, you got purple all wrong, we have to redo it"? Or does he say, "Oh, this is a cool thing, and it reminds me, and I'm giving you a sneaky thing that you can put in that isn't in any novel yet, but I'm going to put it in the third one of the ninth trilogy or whatever"?
Yeah, so I will say, this whole story and sort of what I'm talking about, this is the first time that I've worked with a licensor in this capacity. Uh-huh. But from other veterans on the team, there's a member of the team who's like worked with the Star Wars IP, uh-huh. For example, and he is like, things are getting done so much faster. We are getting much more of a personal touch. I will say, so for Stonewalkers, which is the adventure path that I was talking about that mm-hmm. I kind of came in halfway through and started managing the team on, that is an adventure where the initial outline was written by Sanderson and Dan Wells.
Oh, wow.
And it has your adventuring party fill in the story of like a gap in the novels that shows up on screen in the novels.
A canonical gap.
And I'm so fresh-faced and, you know, don't know what's going on. I'm like, oh, this is normal. And other people on the team are like, what? No, this is a major selling point. Like, IP licensors, you know, don't usually play with these toys kind of thing.
When we were doing Star Trek, Paramount at no time said, why don't you do the Adventures of Captain Sulu in the Excelsior? That would be really helpful to us.
Yeah.
That never happens. Yeah, this couldn't be a better story, frankly, that you quit to do what you love, and it turns out you're so good at it that you're now doing it at the absolute top level of professional responsibility. I mean, is this... obviously, the Cosmere is by no means done, because it's a gigantic world. There could be shelves of role-playing game books, just like there's shelves of novels. Is that something that you're like, I'm Lila Cosmere now for the foreseeable future, I'm going to spend the next 10 years on Cosmere? Do you have other visions of mountains to conquer and universes to climb?
Yeah, well, I think so. The statement of like, oh, you end up as, you know, the project lead of this giant thing, and oh, you're done baking and things are going well. I definitely, like, I am new, you know, I have done some project leadership in other realms, but role-playing games are, you know, somewhat new to me. You know, I've only...
And we're all psychotic divas, too. Yeah. I mean, that's the problem, right? Project management with software engineers must be a walk in the park compared to managing... God forbid you manage me, but, you know...
So, I think the thing I'm going to say...
Even nice, well-behaved writers are terrible people.
The thing that I was going to say is, like, what will keep me on this team and what makes me so excited to be on this team is that I really like my teammates.
Right.
Like, they are... I feel like there's phrases, like, if you feel like you're kind of, like, the dumbest person in the room, you're sort of, like, in the right place. And I don't necessarily... I do feel like I have a lot to add and there's a lot going on.
But you're not the dumbest person in this room, for God's sake.
But it's cool to be in a room where you're, like, I want to... Wow, somebody did something, like, very cool, and I want to learn how to do that,
right,
you know, better. And also, they're a really nice human being who's not, like, you know, trying to backstab you for, like, a job or something,
right,
or
right,
whatever, who's, like, you know... giving up their own time to have a conversation with me about how to, you know, do something or how they think about, like, a design problem. There's a lot of kindness on the team and a lot of, somebody going, like, hey, you seem really enthusiastic about running adventure stuff, you know, take a shot at it. Like, that's a very special position of somebody trusting you,
absolutely,
you know, to be in.
Yeah.
So I do not take, you know, that lightly. So I think it's a... I enjoy the, you know, Cosmere RPG. I very luckily had, like, read all of the Stormlight Archive. I actually, and hopefully the fan community won't come after me for this, but, like, I had read the first book of Mistborn years back, but I never finished the series. So, like, I read it for my job kind of thing.
Right.
So, and I ended up, you know, enjoying it quite a bit.
Look, I had to watch Star Trek Enterprise for my job. You have a much better job than I did.
And I mean, before that, I was doing advocacy work for, like, the Android, like, system that, you know, the Android phones or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I had to read, like, Android API documentation. So it's all an upward trend, right, like, exactly. What you have to read for work. But it's definitely the team and the people. Like, if half of those people switched out for folks that were divas and made my, like, the people management part of my job incredibly hard to do, like, I'm very happy with for the salary that I'm getting that is allowing me to live. But it is not enough to compensate for, like, right. if the people that I was talking with each day were not, you know, good folks. And so, you know, great IP, lot of worlds and things to explore, but also the people in my own kind of, like, personal adventuring party are, like, a solid group that best. I really feel has my back. So.
Well, that's you know, you have basically, you know, walked into the sunlit uplands that we all hope to get to. I could not be happy. Again, we could talk for another half hour about your career path and your choices and your methodologies. I hope people are listening when they're thinking, oh, I can just, you know, sort of slap this together. I don't need anyone to run everything. You do. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us. Is there a place people can find you on the internet and not at all complain about the Mistborn?
My own personal portfolio that is pretty, I think, like, the Cosmere RPG is mentioned on there once because I haven't updated it a bit, but is jaroftheyes.com, and I don't think we have enough time for me to tell the story of that, but jaroftheyes.com.
Always leave them wanting more.
Yeah, and I will say, if you are hearing about kind of this project management stuff and leadership stuff, one of the first things I did when I was throwing spaghetti at the wall was start a Substack, where I did a kind of retrospective tutorial series on everything I did to run a small DM's Guild project. So if you are interested in getting the skills to, like, maybe coordinate people, and you want, like, how do I manage schedules? Like, what is even in a schedule for a small TTRPG project? What did the emails look like when I reached out to, when I cold emailed people that, you know, I wanted to work on the project? How do you deal with royalty splits and, you know, that sort of stuff? That's all on there, and I put a lot of work in it, and I think it's helpful.
And the Substack is under your name or under Jar of Eyes?
If you go, yes, Jar of Eyes, Gazetteer, which I'm probably saying wrong. I need to learn how to say that word, but if you go to jaroftheyes.com and just click on the newsletter button, it'll get you there.
And are you on any socials, or have you...
I'm on Blue Sky.
No time for that nonsense.
I don't post a huge amount, but I'm on Blue Sky under Lila, you know, the sort of the Blue Sky social sort of thing. I, you know, do a lot of sort of reposting of people that I enjoy in the spaces, like content coming out when I release stuff. Like, we didn't get time to talk about it, but Jukebox is my little, like, personal pet project. So, you know, I'll post pictures of people playing at the game at conventions and that kind of stuff.
Fantastic. Well, check out that Substack. I know I will. This has been great. Again, we could have done five times this length and not even scratched the surface of what you're bringing to the hobby and to the industry and to the art form. So thank you so much for doing the interview, and have a great Gen Con.
Thank you. You too.
In the Spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's Eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
and must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Broker a deal for this podcast's continuing survival alongside such beloved Patreon backers as
Scott Jones,
Dare Barefoot,
James Tatum,
Rich Spainauer,
and Oleg.
Well, it seems like forever since we've settled into the Fantasy Film Essential Film Festival, but that's because each of us had our own film festival to attend, and perhaps we're a little distracted. But now, once more, we make our way to the center seat, center aisle of the Cinema Hut, and we settle in, where in our renewed series, it is still the 80s, but it is the late 80s, specifically 1988, because the movie we're watching is Tim Burton's Beetlejuice. And we talked about ghost comedies, perhaps exclusively in the 1940s. Well, this is the ghost comedy for the Memphis Group 80s. Bright colors, crazy nonsense, and then Tim Burton's surreal vision over all of it. Michael Keaton, of course, famously Beetlejuice, the ghost with the most. Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis as sort of the gormless ghosts haunting the unpleasant couple, Jeffrey Jones and the lovely, wonderful Catherine O'Hara. Their innocent daughter, Winona Ryder, becomes the sort of pawn in all of this. And it, again, this could be a 1940s ghost movie, except for the sort of very exciting and delightful sense of surreal, nightmarish danger that Burton and Keaton kind of infuse in this. Danny Elfman, of course, turns in a rollicking score. This is one of his earliest rollicking scores, I believe. And you can't not shout out Otho, if only because no one in the world has ever said Viridian in the same exact and wonderful tone that Glenn Shaddix did in the film.
Yeah. Despite our effort to not re-mention things that were in the Horror Essentials, we mentioned Beetlejuice there in the context of, you know, the horror comedy, of which it is a classic. But it's also a fairy tale. Beetlejuice himself is a Rumpelstiltskin-like figure. The rules govern him. That is how he gets thwarted. It's a weird gothic fairy tale as well as being a horror comedy. It is also... that is the movie where Burton establishes his signature style 100%. His previous film was Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which has a lot of Burton in it, but this is the full Burton experience. And it's the beginning of an incredible run in the late 80s of just extremely satisfying Hollywood blockbuster fantasy films that really succeed on every possible level. They're well-structured, they're well-scripted. Notably, none of them is a part of a second part in a franchise or a sequel. They're all new original stories at a time when people were willing to go and check them out. For example, 1988 brings us Big by Penny Marshall. This is sort of a twist on the Body Switch movie and sort of starts off a new branch of that area of fantasy, the Age Switch movie. So this is a film where a young boy played by David Mosco goes to a carnival, finds an Oracle machine. The Oracle machine magically gives him what he wants, which is the ability to be an adult right away. So he wakes up the next day in the adult body of Tom Hanks, who then goes off and enters the workforce, of course, at a toy company because he has the expertise in which toys are awesome. And he unwittingly becomes involved in a relationship with a coworker played very charmingly by Elizabeth Perkins. And it walks the line of bad taste, but always stays on the right side of it by making sure that Tom Hanks' performance is always that of a complete innocent. So he's never in danger and he's comically misunderstanding things. Robert Loggia is the big boss at the firm, and he takes part in the iconic scene where the two of them dance on the piano keys at FAO Schwartz, the high-end toy store in New York. And it's just a perfect blend of screwball comedy, although the class element of the screwball comedy has been replaced with an age barrier, and the fantasy comedy. And it's one of those ones where it just takes on a tough assignment and absolutely succeeds at it.
Yeah, and just as Harvey could not have succeeded without Jimmy Stewart, Big could not have succeeded without Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks kind of becomes America's new Jimmy Stewart in Big. We saw him in Splash, in which he's a little less lovable. We still root for him, but in Big, I think he completely tapped in to that fundamental audience sympathy that he basically has never let go of since. And yeah, as you say, it's a perfectly crafted comedy. People who saw it once in 1988 still think of it fondly, and I'm sure many people rewatch it just because of those delightful charms. Also in 1988, we have Robert Zemeckis filming and animating at the same time. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? This is a noir comedy set in and around the ethnic neighborhood of cartoons, the Toons. It is loosely adapted from a novel by Gary K. Wolfe, a inferior novel on every respect, by the way. Who Censored Roger Rabbit? This is presented as sort of a gritty noir story that is sort of throws up the innocence of the cartoons to mock them. Who Framed Roger Rabbit makes the much better decision to celebrate the cartoons, and in a historical moment that maybe could never happen before or since, you get Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse both showing up for an identical number of minutes, as it happens, thanks to their contract. And you still had Mel Blanc doing all the voices of the Warner Brothers characters. You had the great June Foray from Rocky and Bullwinkle doing Wheezy and Lena Hyena. You have Charles Fleischer doing Roger Rabbit. And in the, boundary between human and cartoon, we have Christopher Lloyd as the villain, a part he was born to play, a horrendous threat to cartoon paradise. And you can't let the movie go without mentioning the best Philadelphia accent ever done by a British person, Bob Hoskins as Eddie Valiant. This is the first movie I saw Hoskins in. And then when I saw The Long Good Friday, I was like, man, he does a great British accent, and was disabused of that belief.
His performance in this is so great because you really need him to believe everything that's going on to have enough credibility to make this work. And right. He really sells that. And in an era where it was not yet standard for every actor to learn to act with a tennis ball and a stick as their scene partner.
Right. And speaking of scene partners, we should mention Kathleen Turner's uncredited performance as Jessica Rabbit. I assume this was to establish Jessica Rabbit's credibility as an independent star like Bugs Bunny. I'm not precisely sure why you wouldn't take credit for that, but it's magnificent, of course. It's a terrific movie. It looks amazing. Even now, still, it looks amazing. And in 1988, it just melted the eyeballs of everyone who saw it, because you did not have that kind of fluidity of live action animation blending. This is way beyond Dick Van Dyke dancing with penguins in Mary Poppins, as glorious as those were. This is the next level. And in a way, as you suggest, is the golden exemplar that all garbage CGI movies should be looking back at and ask, what did we do wrong?
Yes, on a technical level, it is comparable to the Jurassic Park phenomenon in terms of its blend of animation and live action. The innovation here technically is a moving camera with these characters rather than having them in the typical locked master shot. And also it culminates into a big exciting finish. And it's actually a pretty good film noir plot, in part because it references the death of the LA streetcar, or the murder of the LA streetcar system, which is been compared to the earlier theft of water rights. So in a sense, it's also a better sequel to Chinatown than The Two Jakes was. So
yes.
It really works on so many different levels and is extremely entertaining and is absolutely worth checking out. Speaking of landmarks in animation, we now get to The Little Mermaid from 1989, directed by Ron Clements and John Musker. And this is the resurgence of Disney animation with the Hans Christian Andersen adaptation into the Disney formula, where Jodie Benson plays Ariel, the singing mermaid who wants to be human at least long enough to figure out what's going on with this handsome prince It's a kind of a transitional piece in that of the voice actors, you've got Samuel Wright as Sebastian, René Auberjonois as Louis, and Pat Carroll as a great Disney villain as Ursula. But you've got like Buddy Hackett playing Scuttle the seagull. So that's sort of a callback to the way that Disney used to cast its voice actors as sort of an older generation of performers with a bit of Vegas Borscht Belt stuff going on. But it's so splendidly realized that it revived Disney animation, in fact, revived Disney and created the foundation, not only from the creative perspective, but also the business perspective for it to eventually turn into the incredible media monolith that it is today. But you might want to put that out of your head.
Yeah.
As you put The Little Mermaid back in the machine to check it out and remember that it is just as energetic and sweet and fun as you remember it when you originally saw it.
And also, I would argue, the best songs of any of the new Disney movies, Ashman and Macon, managed to do the unthinkable and provide a musical sound that harkens back, as you say, to sort of the Tin Pan Alley Buddy Hackett days, but also feel very contemporary and certainly charm the socks off 8 zillion little girls then and now. And it is a glorious soundtrack. They neared those heights with later films for Disney, but I think that this marks both their debut and their high point as composers.
Yeah. Filling the shoes of the Sherman Brothers, the previous in-house songwriters at Disney, was a huge, huge challenge, and they rose to that and exceeded it.
Exactly. In 1990, then we will conclude with another Tim Burton, and this is, rather than the Tim Burton fairy tale, this is the Tim Burton sort of fantastic gothic. The film, of course, is Edward Scissorhands. Johnny Depp is a construct built by a kindly Frankenstein type, played by Vincent Price. Vincent Price gives him scissors for hands, hence the name of the movie, and then inconveniently dies, leaving Edward alone in the world to be taken in by the lovely Boggs family, Alan Arkin, Diane Wiest, and Winona Ryder, again as the love interest. This presents him first with a suburban world, a normal world, although it's a Tim Burton normal, so it's not at all normal, world to interact with, both to desire and then to be driven away from, Frankenstein style. So this is the Frankenstein story, but in the tenor of pure fantasy and sort of, what do I want to say? The notion of the magical outsider from the outsider's perspective. And of course, Depp gives a performance that is as good as Boris Karloff's as the original Frankenstein, and therefore probably the second best Frankenstein that has ever been put on screen. Frankenstein type, I should say.
Yes. It is Burton's most autobiographical film. It also really works as a love story. But as you point out, it's about the outsider initially fitting in with the community and then having one tiny misunderstanding turning everything on its head. And you see, even more so in Frankenstein, that's not so much the theme. But here, it is the theme of pretty much, I bet Del Toro's version of this will have the exact same theme, not as well executed, which is that, you know, the society, the people with the pitchforks and the torches are the monsters, and the monsters, a misunderstood, lovely person who just doesn't know how to talk to people and doesn't know how to express themselves and get along. And sort of kawaii goth aesthetic that Burton is moving toward in Beetlejuice, it reaches its apotheosis here. And that's what makes this an undoubted fantasy classic. And we'll be back next week with more fantasy classics. But now it's time for us to move on to our final hut of this here episode. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North,
covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
We're going to wander into a hut whose full confines are initially confounding to us because we're not really sure, unlike the other huts, what's going on, because there's a guy in the corner. He's muttering some sort of long, weird historical chronology. There's another guy who's got a map, but it's not the good kind of map we talk about in the cartography hut. I just don't know what's happening here until I look out the window, and there, screaming on the moor, is an alien big cat. Over in the corner, we see our gray alien, our Nordic alien, and they're sharing their kombucha this time around with a ghost, because they know that this pertains to them, yet also to ghosts, because beloved patron backer Gray St. Quentin says, weird haunted stuff that goes on in Cambridge was mentioned by Ken in an episode as something that would be appropriate for an Elliptony hut. Please, can I invoke my priority question asking access to request this hut? And of course, he refers to Cambridge in the UK. That's the Cambridge you think about when you don't specify. And Ken, normally when you tackle a segment like this, I'll try and do a little bit of research to have a few little things to fling in, you know, a couple of sprigs of rosemary, as it were. But you found so many things for Cambridge that I'm just going to prompt you to tell us about them, starting off with something weird and monstrous about some nearby hills.
Yeah, Cambridge, the town, and also university. And when a university has been in the same place, has been doing things for 800 years, ghosts going to accumulate, weirdness going to accumulate. That's sort of the point. But perhaps they only accumulate because they are flanked and embedded in the Gogmagog Hills. A name like that, obviously, it connotes giants and folk legendary. I went to Cambridge for a game convention. I was invited out, and they said you should write a little suppressed transmission type thing for the program book. And I said, okay, I'm sure I can come up with something in Cambridge. And I looked at a map, and I saw the Gogmagog Hills, and 2,000 words later, I hadn't gotten out of the hills. So that was my sort of introduction to Cambridge, and let's let it be ours as well. The Gogmagog Hills may have been named the Hodmadod Hills after a sort of figure of a snail that was built in stone on the top of the hills called the Wandlebury Camp, or it may be named after the biblical giants Gog and Magog, who became the British legendary giants Gog and Magog. We don't know, but snails and giants, that sounds like our line of country. And to top it off, most recently, the Gogmagog Hills have been the site of a phantom monkey sighting. So phantom monkeys, mystical snail energy, and giants. I don't know if you need any more. And we haven't even gotten to town yet.
Right. Technically, this is more Tradecraft Hut than Elliptony Hut, but there is a secret society practicing treason.
Yes, the a secret society we're speaking of is the Apostles, which is sort of a student club like Skull and Bones at Yale or whatever. In this case, it is a secret society meant to talk and debate, but by the 20th century, it was a secret society meant to talk and debate homosexuality, and not so much debate it as practice it. And so they had a secret society because it was, of course, illegal and shunned to be gay. That's not the dangerous, weird part. The dangerous, weird part is that amongst their recruits and members were members of the Cambridge Five, the traitors to Britain, who all worked for the KGB, Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, Anthony Blunt, and that lot. And so that is the Apostles' claim to fame. So if you have a secret society just toddling along since 1820 that suddenly becomes a hotbed of communist treason, I feel like that is pregnant with occult storification, if you wish.
However, our aliens are not so interested in that. So tell us about the UFOs at Cambridge.
The most famous UFOs at Cambridge are the Cambridge Lights, which was a flap in 1978. A bunch of mysterious moving lights showed up over Cambridge. Everyone saw them. They asked questions. No one could say what was going on. It was a wonderful UFO moment for everyone. They've had a minor UFO flap, about six sightings in 2015 and 2016 of craft and aliens. Those tapered off in 2017. So I assume that these were the aliens coming back to pick up their degree or something. I don't know. But either way, obviously Cambridge has got, you know, nuclear physics laboratories and all kinds of other stuff. So if the aliens are curious about that kind of thing, Cambridge is where they would go a look in.
Now, we've gotten to Cambridge University proper, and like many universities, it is divided into a number of colleges. Many of these go back many, many hundreds of years. And if you're going to have a college for hundreds of years, you're going to attract ghosts. So we're going to go in a little survey of the different colleges and their ghosts, beginning with a somewhat murdery ghost found at Christ College.
Yeah, this is the ghost of Christopher Round, who is often seen in his tall hat. He haunts the mulberry tree garden, and he sort of wanders around it in his hat looking sad because he had a rival in love. And when the rival fell into the pond near the mulberry tree, Round picked up a branch and held him under with it and drowned him because he wanted sole access to the young lady. In some versions, the guy he drowned was a medical student who, of course, could have saved the young lady's life in the killing fever that took her. But, you know, I don't know that you need that to explain why Christopher Round feels bad about drowning his former BFF.
Now, many university administrators, I think, begin to feel that they are turning into ghosts. But at Corpus Christi College, one of them actually went through with it.
Yes, this is Henry Butts. He was the former vice chancellor of the college. He was the vice chancellor during a outbreak of the plague in Cambridge, and he stayed behind. He did not flee, so good for him. But perhaps as a result of things he saw or had to do during that harsh time, he hanged himself on Easter of 1632. And so his ghost is seen on Easter, certainly was seen Easter 1904, has been seen since. And you go up to the guy and you tap him on the shoulder and he turns around and you see that he has a giant ligature mark in his throat and you've seen the ghost of Henry Butts. And that's how he manifests to you. So whatever was going on, he has not worked through it yet.
Now, Clare College says, Vice Chancellor, ha, we have the ghost of our founder, Elizabeth de Clare.
Yes, she is nicknamed the Black Widow of the Cam, and this is because she had the inconvenient habit of marrying rich husbands who suddenly died. And some versions of this story make it out like she killed them. If you go and you do the research, they were, you know, nobles during a time when Britain is basically in a state of civil war. They got killed in fracases of one or another kind. She is blameless in all of this, but she did accumulate, you know, she began with a substantial inheritance and she kept marrying up. So she wound up accumulating a huge amount of money from three husbands. Then she sort of put that on pause. As said, I'm beginning to sort of lose steam in this, so I will take my money and I will found a Clare College. She dies in 1360, and she supposedly haunts the River Cam, which is the river that goes through Cambridge, at Clare Bridge, her eponymous bridge. I don't know if she's a drowny ghost or just an appeary ghost, but there she is in the river, and I suppose if you're under the Clare Bridge, you should take care for either kind.
Now, lest you think that every ghost is a named ghost with a historical provenance who left behind a bunch of letters and a map and stuff, Emmanuel College just has the stomping footsteps of a ghost, but this is a ghost that turned out to be rather determined.
Yeah, we don't know who the ghost was. There doesn't even seem to be any legend about it. They just say, well, you hear the stomping footsteps, you know it's the ghost. And this used to be in the dorms, basically, the rooms of Emmanuel House. And they thought to themselves back in the Victorian times, we will cleverly knock down Emmanuel House and rebuild it. And then that will take care of this ghost. And for a while, it seems to have, but the stomping footsteps did come back. So merely knocking down a building is no way to necessarily get rid of the ghost, especially if the ghost doesn't have to be tied to a specific dorm room the way that Henry Butts might.
Now, we have a common style of ghost at Girton College. They have a gray lady.
Yes, they have a gray lady. She appears on the staircase at Girton. And this is appropriate, of course, because Girton was the college created to allow female undergraduates at Cambridge. And so what better for them than a female ghost, a gray lady? And I feel like she's probably the kind of ghost that says, you go, girl, not the kind of ghost that says, repent and tries to kill you. But who knows? She's gray.
Right. So where ghosts are concerned, you got to figure that M.R. James's college would have to have something distinctive. So this brings in animal ghosts, but not just any animal ghost, Ken.
No, these are the ghosts of Oliver Cromwell's horses. When Cromwell captured Cambridge during the Civil War, he didn't respect any old Anglican chapel and certainly not at a college he didn't go to. So he stabled his horses in the chapel at King's college. Well, the horses, they wanted no part of this blasphemy. They felt very bad about it. And so the chapel is still haunted by those horses to this day. And often you hear them on the roof, which is a very inconvenient place for horses of any kind.
Right. But we all know that horses are staunchly C of E. So
exactly. Well, they're by and large high church animals, I feel. Also on Kings is a building called the Gibbs Building, which is haunted by the screaming ghost of a former student there named James Barrett. And James Barrett went to Kings. He was in the Gibbs Building. He had a coffin in his room and he screamed a lot. And this being Cambridge, everyone said, well, what are you going to do? But one day he was not screaming. They got worried. They opened his door and there he was dead in his coffin. And at the moment they said, well, I guess that's the end of James Barrett. But no, he still screams to this day, or to this night, I assume, in the Gibbs Building. And so I suppose figuring out what his damage is would be a big part of that. But no one seems to know, even in the make him up parts of the story.
That definitely sounds like an M.R. James style ghost.
Yeah.
Peterhouse College has another former administrator who hanged himself.
Yes, this is Francis Dawes. He was the bursar of Peterhouse. He was passed over in the election for master of Peterhouse in 1789 and hanged himself as a result. That seems like an awfully strong response to a pretty minor setback, but I'm not in the running for master of Peterhouse. Maybe I have this wrong. His ghost has appeared as late as 1997. He appeared about 6 times in that year, and they tried to exorcise him. Again, C of E exorcism. I don't know that it took. Again, varying stories, but I feel like if you're not even going to knock the building down, why are you even trying? So Francis Dawes is still no doubt hanging around.
Right. St. John's College has a profusion of ghosts. They're stacked on top of one another.
Yeah, it's partially because it is built on a medieval hospital. So, of course, you have a whole bunch of people who died in agony and possibly unshriven, depending on how rapidly the brothers of St. John could get there. This is a hospital of St. John. Everyone says so. Is it a Knight Hospitaller holding is the question. Now, the Knights Hospitaller are the Knights of the Hospital of St. John. This is a Hospital of St. John. So either, yes, it's a Hospitaller holding, or even better, it's a covert Hospitaller holding. So no doubt some sort of tricksy crusader magic is occurring in this hospital. The hospital is suppressed in 1511, not for being full of crusader magic, but for only having 3 monks in it. And so they were like, we're going to use that building for something better, specifically for St. John's College. Previously, the hospital had academic status on the school, but now it's a full college after that. And it has been haunted by ghosts ever since. In 1706, 4 obvious player characters drove away a congeries of ghosts with gunplay. In 1746, a student named James Ashton was stabbed at St. John's by another student who got off on the technicality of being rich and connected. And so James Ashton is still steamed about that and still haunts St. John's. Another student, James Wood, who grew up to be a famous mathematician and died in 1839, but was bitterly poor when he was at St. John's. And so after he died, he comes back. I don't know if it's a haunt in protest of better living conditions, or if it's just, well, that's where he suffered so much trauma that he's pinned there like a bug on a card. And then the best ghost of all, the best thing at St. John's, and I would argue in Cambridge, is the anomalous big cat. It's a massive black animal that has been seen all over the grounds beginning in 1996. It is perhaps the same as the anomalous big cat known as the Fen Tiger, who is in the Fen country to the northeast of Cambridge. But either way, we've got a big cat. He doesn't even have to have a moor to howl on. He can howl in the gated confines of St. John's College.
Now, if you're not scared by Cromwell's devout horses, head on over to Sydney Sussex College, where there you will find the ghost of Cromwell's head.
Yes, Cromwell's head, dug up by Charles, put on a pike, traded amongst British antiquarians after that, and it wound up at Sydney Sussex College because that was Cromwell's college as an undergraduate. And the guy says, I have Cromwell's head, would you give it a burial? And they said, well, legacy, we have to take him. So they bury his head in the chapel. And that was buried in 1960. And since then, The ghost of his head, a pale yellow head without ears, so a little Mr. Wild energy from Repair of Reputations, seen there in 1967 and again since. So a floating Cromwell head, another terrific ghost. It almost, you know, makes the elderly Dawn, who wanders around Sydney, Sussex, and goes into rooms and says, oh, I'm sorry, I thought this was my room, and then vanishes because he's a ghost, seem uninteresting. And that's just the way it is, right? You can't compete with Cromwell's floating head, I feel.
Now, the player characters are asking themselves, can't we have like one college that isn't haunted where we can set up our headquarters? So we recommend Trinity College, which was the home of the Ghost Club.
The Ghost Club was undergraduates who wanted to talk and discuss ghosts and investigate ghost stuff. That began there in 1855. Many, many famous people were members of the Ghost Club. Harry Price is the guy that sort of refounded it in London in the 30s and brought it to its second great wave of success. But also at Trinity College was the archaeologist T.C. Lethbridge, who attempted to excavate the giants on the Gog Magog Hills later, and he saw an apparition in a top hat in the New Court at Trinity in 1922, and between that and all the other archaeologists laughing at him, he decided to become a parapsychologist later in life. So T.C. Lethbridge, Cambridge weirdness in one beautiful package.
Speaking of big cats, the Fitzwilliam Museum has a legend attached to it.
It does. When I was at Fitzwilliam, I love Fitzwilliam. It's the museum on campus. I perhaps perturbed beloved Patreon backer Phil Masters by referring to it as the best small museum I'd ever seen. I don't think you're expected to call the Fitzwilliam small, but it has two stone lions, like every proper museum has. But since it's Cambridge, they come alive at midnight and they walk down and drink out of the gutter. There's usually a channel of water flowing by because England, and the lions get thirsty just standing there all the time. So who doesn't love animate stone lions? Any museum in the world would be happy to have those.
Now, in addition to college ghosts, Cambridge has townie ghosts.
Yes.
Particularly at a place called Abbey House, which has as many ghosts per square foot as you could possibly ask for.
Yeah, Abbey House is possibly the most haunted house in Cambridge. The snootier ghost books are like, well, we don't like to use the term most haunted, but Abbey House is haunted by a nun, a brown thing, a poltergeist, ghostly echoes of chains, a butler, a woman in white, a gray lady, a squirrel, a dog, and a rabbit or hare. Obviously, you can't species type a ghost, but it hops around and has long ears, so you pay your money, you take your choice. But Abbey House is a sitcom waiting to happen with all these ghosts in it.
Right. And Pellegrine founder Simon Rogers is absolutely the most terrified by the ghost squirrel.
Right.
Now, of course, at hospitals, you tend to see ghosts. I'm a little skeptical of this claim, though, about Addenbrooke's Hospital, I have to say.
Yes, in Addenbrooke's Hospital, ghosts appear to the patients that are on morphine. And I believe that there is perhaps a question is maybe this is just the local mixture of morphine rather than the
or
local mixture of ghosts.
Or just any morphine.
Right.
If anyone has had the misfortune to have a family member in the hospital who's needed to be sedated to that degree with morphine, who is particularly an elderly patient, you're lucky if the worst thing they see is ghosts, let me tell you.
Yep.
So on happier news, how about a black dog, the monstrous symbol of depression?
Right. Yes, the black dog is only one of the many road ghosts that crisscross Cambridge's streets. The black shuck appears on Arbury Road. He's been seen since medieval times, and he brings you bad luck if you see him, which I guess is if you're out on Arbury Road after curfew, you're probably inviting your own bad luck. Howgate Road has a mystery wallaby seen in 2019. That was very exciting. A girl in blue, a ghostly girl in blue seen on Huntingdon Road in 2014. One assumes Cambridge blue being the color. You see girls in blue all the time, but only seldom ghosts. But the best of all, Robin, is the furry penguin-like creature seen on Newmarket Road. And I like that some ghostologist has not so much fun ruined it, but fun refined it to say that it's not a ghostly, furry, penguin-like creature. That's crazy and makes no sense. It's a ghostly plague doctor. That's the obvious explanation. So good for him.
That's the still fun, but considerably less fun option compared to furry, penguin-like creature.
Yep.
Any English town with an airport has to have some phantom airmen.
Yes, the Cambridge Airport, like many Airports that were used as RAF bases during World War II have phantom RAF pilots, ghosts of men who took off from that airport and were shot down and came back as ghosts. The other place that phantom RAF airmen show up, just like real RAF airmen, is the bar near the airport. So the Eagle Pub has plenty of RAF pilots ghost, phantomly ghosting, plus a poltergeist that gets mad if you close the upstairs window, because according to legend, the window was stuck closed sometime in the misty ghost past when the top floor of the pub caught fire and a child was burned to death. And whether the child is the poltergeist or whether the poltergeist is just mad at that neglect happening, it makes sure that that window stays open. And if you shut it, bad luck will follow you till you get it back open again. So, word to the wise.
Now, Ken, I hope I never find out that you are haunting anything, but if I do, I will look in bookstores, possibly not in Cambridge, but there's some haunted bookstores there.
Yes, there are. Sheraton and Hughes Books was haunted by a ghost. It is now closed, sadly. It was haunted by a white lady in Victorian dress. I don't know if she haunts the, you know, telephone store or whatever they have there now, but there is also in Cambridge a bookstore called The Haunted Bookshop. And the proprietor named it after the Christopher Morley novel, The Haunted Bookshop. And much to their chagrin, it turns out to be haunted. So there you go.
Yeah. If you call your ice cream parlor the haunted ice cream parlor, you're going to get ghosts. Don't do that. Not recommended.
It's an attractive nuisance.
Right. However, that is not the most disturbing retail ghost in Cambridge, because a sweet shop resounds with the sounds of an axe murder.
Yes, this is on East Street, and this is only one of three haunted shops on East Street, so that's like the ghost district, but it is the worst one, certainly, because axe murder, that's pretty dire. You don't want that.
Right. And we don't want to imply that there are no, in addition to the institutional and retail ghosts, of course, there's residential ghosts. There's lots of individual houses that are haunted.
Right. And this, in addition to Abbey House, we have other haunted houses. These are all from different houses, but there is a woman in green with a red feather in her hat who was seen in the 1890s, and her shtick would be that someone would be looking at a painting in the house, and it was a painting of a woman in green with a feather in her hat, and they would say, "I wonder who that woman was," and the woman would say, "Oh, it was me," and then you'd turn back and notice that the painting was done 100 years ago, and then she'd be gone. So she just likes hanging around her painting, which I guess makes sense.
The ghostly docent.
There's a tubercular lady ghost that was seen in a hammock in a house in 1924. I feel like if I'm not at the bookshop, I might be ghostly in the hammock. There's an old man in a trilby hat, no year attached to him, but he was seen in a Cambridge house. A moaning man heard in a freezing room in 1996. Again, this is England, so the room may have just been freezing in a non-supernatural way, but the moaning man is unusual. A bomb victim child was seen in a house in 2014. I don't know if the child was bombed by the IRA or by the Nazis, but either way, he's a bomb victim child, and he turned up. And then lastly, sort of raw material of ghosts bubbling up in 2023, 2024, we have a dark, shadowy figure. So perhaps in time, that dark, shadowy figure will coalesce into a man in a trilby hat or something. But for right now, he's just a
fresh enough ghost that he's post-pandemic.
Exactly. Yeah.
The ghosts keep coming. Well, normally we have a bit at the end of the Liptony Hut where we gamify it, but it's obvious you're in the ghost club at Trinity and you investigate all of these cases.
All these crazy ghosts.
Question answered. So we'll be back next week with more segments of weirdness and erudition. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Sepple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from Oliver Cromwell's ghost head by joining such fearless backers as
Eric R.
Peter Atkinson.
Chad Ward.
Jim Crocker.
And Michael Curtis.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, 3i Atlas. It's a really fun space rock.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.